Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. More and more, Granite Staters seem to prefer local beer, with a recent mini-boom in so-called craft beer made here. Just 5 years ago, there were about 20 craft breweries in the state. Today, there are at least 54. Festivals celebrating New Hampshire beer draw big crowds, and at UNH, you can even get a minor degree in beer making. But while craft brewing generates lots of attention, does it generate lots of money? How much of a local or statewide economic boost does it really provide? It's a question posed to NHPR's Only in New Hampshire's series recently, in which we try to answer your inquiries about life in the Granite State. And it's worth looking at, as some communities are betting on local beer, hoping it will draw more tourists and even add a cool factor to their towns that might encourage more young people to move in. Today in the Exchange, the business of beer. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. With us in studio, Nicole Carrier, co-founder and president of Throwback Brewery in Northampton. She's president of the New Hampshire Brewers Association. And Nicole, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Michael Hauptley-Pierce, owner and brewer at Litherman's Limited in Concord, host of the beer podcast, The Tap Handle Show. And Michael, it's good to see you too. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Well, Nicole, to you first, why should somebody who doesn't drink beer or doesn't really care that much about beer be interested in this whole craft brew boom that we're seeing?
Good question. Well, first of all, I'd say they should try craft beer because I feel like there's so much variety in craft beer that there's got to be a beer out there for someone. But in general, like if someone really cares about the state of New Hampshire and the economic impact, craft beer in New Hampshire has a $359 million impact to our state. We have over 65 little breweries that are adding all sorts of fun activities and community building in their towns, and also contributing back by adding jobs really helping out some economies.
So it's an economic driver.
It absolutely is an economic driver, yes.
You know, one of the themes that's come up on this program again and again, Nicole, is the sort of the rise of the health of the cities in New Hampshire, but then small towns are struggling. So I just wonder how you see the economics of this in terms of cities like Portsmouth or Concord or Manchester versus little towns.
Yeah, well, there's breweries popping up in all sorts of little areas. And, you know, we're in Northampton, which is pretty close to Portsmouth. But, you know, there weren't any other breweries in our town when we started, and we saw everyone in our town being really happy they didn't have to go into Portsmouth. You know, we started in a little tiny warehouse park and, you know, not the best ambiance in the world. We would open up the garage door. We'd like throw out some plastic chairs. People would come because they got to meet other people, try some interesting things. And it was a really fun way to spend like a Friday night or a Saturday afternoon. And I see that happening, like not just in our state, but in other states across the country. You can open up a little brewery, you know, in a less populated area. And because it's people are proud of their breweries, they want to support them, it draws people in, and you could hire folks from around the area as well.
So it's a community builder, not just an economic
driver. Absolutely, yeah.
And it kind of reminds me of Germany, right, where each little town has its own beer.
Yep, own beer, own style and way of doing things. You know, every brewery has different events that they run. Like, I've taken people on paddleboarding trips. You know, we're going to go on a growler tour to Maine. So it's not just what we can do for, you know, right in our backyard, but also building friendships and networks and then, you know, having new experiences together as well.
How would you answer that question, Michael? Why should somebody who, you know, isn't that interested in beer, maybe they drink one occasionally, care about this whole trend that we're seeing?
Well, I think part of what we're seeing is that people are more concerned about where things come from. And we went, you know, through the 50s of you buy everything in a can, you buy everything in a box. It's Betty Crocker. It's Mother's Little Helper. And we ended up with box stores. And I think the pendulum is steadily swinging in the other direction where people, even if they don't so much care about beer, they care about the fact that they're not supporting a company that's trying to put all the other companies out of business, all the little people out of business, that's just important for vitality of the economy in general. Whether or not you consume that product, it's good that it's made where you live. It's just good for a lot of reasons. It employs people. If it's something like beer, it probably does add vitality, whether it's downtown or whether it's in an industrial park. And I got to say, I love the place you guys have now, but that little spot you guys had at the beginning was so awesome. I got goosebumps when I heard you talking about, like, I remember how cool it was hanging out there. Yeah. So that's important. It does. It adds a reason for people to come in and spend money in your town. And in the end, that's what keeps the wheels turning, right?
Well, where you are is also sort of a funny little place.
We're gritty.
Gritty. There you go. I mean, it's kind of like a little industrial park, a lot of little businesses there that sort of come and go. I wonder how that's working for you, being in that sort of odd little pocket off of downtown.
We were a little concerned, and we had another spot that we were originally in another town, and for a lot of reasons, we pulled up stakes before we got them too deep and did a search, and we looked at 45 places, and this was like the 45th or 46th, and it was perfect for a lot of reasons. I won't go into detail, but for infrastructure, it was great. But what we didn't realize is being so close to where 89 and 93 go from 5 lanes to 2 lanes, that anytime there's a mass exodus in one direction or the other and people get tired, they get off the highway at that interchange and they Google beer and I'm 0.3 miles away. So they have to make a couple of turns through an industrial park. But when people are going to the mountains or people are going to the beach or people are going to Vermont or people are going to the lake, they stop. And we get a lot of people that have never been there before and say, wow, you're here. You know, we do this every month, every quarter, every year. You are now part of our route.
Wow.
And so it's worked.
So even though you didn't get some maybe more expensive, cozy piece of real estate in Concord's beautifully remodeled downtown, where you are, even though it's gritty, it kind of works.
People wander digitally. You know, they don't just walk around a downtown. They say, I'm here. What am I going to do? Let me pull out my phone. Here's where I'm going to wander, and they plan it that way. So it's worked for us because we're findable. And we put a lot of effort into social media and grassroots word of mouth, so I think we pervade.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to add, we sort of mentioned a little bit about beer tourism, but it is a real thing. And it made me think of it, like 72% of our website traffic is from mobile devices. So people are looking for beer. And we're right near the beach. When it rains, we're busy because people are, oh no, we're going to go to the beach. What do we do? They pull out their phone, they Google brewery, and they end up at our place. And on the weekends, we see people from all over, not just New Hampshire, coming in wanting to explore on their vacations.
What is craft brew, Nicole?
There's an official definition from the Brewers Association. I know we have Bart coming on later, the economist at the Brewers Association. But in general, it's beer made by small and independent brewers. And there's also a second level definition that sort of implied about having, you know, a lot of creativity and innovation and ingenuity, I think, really kind of defines what craft beer is.
So a couple subjective terms there.
Absolutely.
Small is subjective. Yep. Independent could be subjective. Ingenuity is definitely subjective.
That's totally subjective, yes. But actually, the small, like you could measure by a number of barrels.
Sure.
Yeah. And so when Sam Adams is at the, or Boston Beer Company to be more exact, is at the very, very top of what a craft brewer is.
I think of them as big.
Yep, they're absolutely big. And in fact, the Brewers Association has been changing some of the definitions so that they can still fit in to craft beer. But independent means, you know, owned either by the people that, you know, not by a big conglomeration or corporation like Budweiser, for example.
So, Michael, can a corporation like Anheuser-Busch, which has a facility here in New Hampshire, by the way, and which sells a lot of beer in the Granite State, can it make a craft beer if it's lovingly produced by a small group of people, you know, in a different site who just happened to work for that big company?
Well, I think that what Nicole said is dead on, in that it's the cutting edge is a moving target, so it's hard to define it. And craft is cutting edge. It's not what it was 10 years ago, because that's not craft anymore necessarily. Can a big company make craft beer? I think that a lot of craft is the spirit and the soul. And from a boardroom table, it's really easy to discount that as you can't measure that on a P&L. You can't put a value on that. But the truth is, you can't put a value on that, because it's beyond value that you can measure. And if you're a corporation that really is just trying to destroy an industry for the sake of another industry, then I don't think you can really be a part of that industry that you're trying to destroy. And I think in some ways, the big boys really don't care about the little guys that they're buying. I think they're just sort of pawns in a game to try to get things the way they were 30 years ago. And
Are they trying to destroy it? That's a pretty serious charge. Or are they just trying to jump into the game?
I think the people that have legacy macros wish those legacy macros were still the top tier. And they're not anymore, because this whole new tier of craft got created 25 years ago when it was not even called craft. But it used to be that, you know, Budweiser was the top shelf, and below that was the second tiers, the Schlitzes, and then below that was the yellow can that said beer that your dad bought when he got laid off. You know, that was kind of what you had for options. And now there's this thing on top of that, and they don't want that thing on top anymore. And I honestly feel personally that especially certain companies that own a lot of small beer holdings would like to just see those companies go away, even if they're the ones they've recently bought, because they just really want to sell their big brands, because it's so much easier. Their guys are out selling 2-3 things. They don't have a 20-page portfolio. They don't have all this marketing to deal with. It's just one thing that they're feeding to the masses, and I think they want to get it back there.
Is there an element, Michael, of mechanization that is included in this definition of craft?
I think that depends on who you ask. If you ask a lot of guys that are like me or gals that are like me that are small, 3-barrel, we only make 100 gallons at a time, maybe they'll resent that because they're kind of jealous. It's like their neighbor that has the cool lawnmower for the big lawn when you've got the little push behind for your little lawn. But I think you can still make great beer on amazing systems, because it's about consistency. If you can systematize that consistency, it doesn't mean you can't have amazing ideas. It just means you can do them the same every time. So no, I don't think that's a hindrance at all.
Do you want to jump in, Nicole?
Yeah, sure.
Can Anheuser-Busch make craft beer? They've certainly been buying up.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because they call it craft. We or you know, in general, the industry calls it crafty, right? Because someone like
crafty,
crafty, yeah. Because for example, Coors makes and produces Blue Moon, and I don't know if most people know that, but technically, according to the Brewers Association definition, that's not a craft beer, but it is craft. Like, because it has, you know, the packaging and sort of a lot of the flavor descriptors of what a normally a craft beer would seem like. I think for me, and Michael talked a little bit about his feelings about the larger breweries. I think it's a little bit scary to be a small brewery competing against large breweries like AB InBev or Budweiser, because they have so much control over distribution, right? They, as part of their big company, they have all these distributors that might just want to distribute their products, or they could buy up, like, for example, all of the hops coming from South Africa, right? So there's both ends, being able to push your beer out into the market and being able to get the supplies or the inputs that you need. It's scary to have someone that potentially could, you know, cut off both of those avenues for a small brewer. So, yeah, they can make crafty beer, but in terms of, you know, being on the same playing field and trying to be independent and a small business, it's just they're two totally different things.
So when Michael talks about destroying craft beer, and I was like, whoa, that's pretty serious. But you're saying in terms of both distribution and in terms of the inputs that you need,
yep,
they have an ability to make things extremely difficult.
Make it hard, yes. Yep.
The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Today in Exchange, we're looking at the business of brewing, specifically independent craft beer here in New Hampshire. There's been a mini boom in recent years in craft beer brewing in the Granite State. We'd love to hear from you, your questions, comments, observations, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, theexchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like, NHPR. exchange. So, Nicola and Michael, we've talked about what is a craft brew, what is independent, can the big guys make craft or crafty beer. What's a nano, Michael? What's a nano brewery?
Well, that's something that I don't know, actually, if any other state has laws on the books for. Am I correct that we're the only one, Nicola?
We're the only one, yep.
So something that was created about 5 years ago to allow really, really small producers making, you know, anywhere from 30 to 150 gallons at a time and give them some breaks. So the barrier to entry for taxation and for licensing is lower. You're allowed to self-distribute. You're allowed to sell samples in your tasting room. You're allowed to do things that beverage manufacturers weren't allowed to do before. And it used to be that you could be a beverage manufacturer or you could be a brew pub. And those are sort of the only licenses you could have to make beer. And they both sort of required big infrastructure and a high barrier to entry. So this was allowing people that wanted to start small and maybe stay small or maybe just test the waters, be able to do that without, I mean, you're still looking at a sizable investment to start a brewery. It's six figures to do it right, but it's not seven. And I think that's what changed.
So, and this was a law, right, put forward by Congresswoman Annie Custer of the 2nd District, right, Nicole? And the goal was to make it easier for small breweries to get started.
Yep. And when we got started over 6 years ago, this law was just about to be passed. So we actually started as a beverage manufacturer. And then we quickly transitioned into a nanobrewery. So we were the first nanobrewery in the state that actually had a tasting room. And so sort of showed how that model
in a garage
could
with plastic
work.
Chairs.
In a garage with plastic chairs. And technically it's a small brewery that can produce up to 2,000 barrels of beer a year.
And New Hampshire is the only state with this. So what kind of a difference has that made, Nicole?
Well, it's, as Michael said, it made the barriers to entry a little bit lower. But I also think that's sort of a perceived, you know, people think, oh, it's easy to get into brewing because we have this law. But when you get into it, it's still a pretty expensive proposition. Lots of hard work to start a brewery. But since that time, we now have 65 plus breweries in our state. And if you look...
Because of this?
In part because of that, absolutely. The thing that's interesting is that if you look at all of the breweries across the state, only 9, I think, make more than 2,000 barrels of beer a year. And there's also a bunch of brew pubs, but for all intents and purposes, the vast majority of breweries in the state make less than 500 barrels of beer.
So most of them are nanos.
Most of them are nanos, yep.
Okay, I'm going to ask you guys now something that you will not like.
Okay.
You ready? Why is Vermont, Michael, considered sort of the beer mecca and New Hampshire is sort of meh?
You're
broad public perception.
I think the easy answer is that Vermont is crunchier than we are, regardless of what we think. And that's sort of national perception. But I think the fact that Vermont Pub and Brewery happened, 30 years ago, and Greg Noonan was there, and he kind of created the legislation that allowed him to open a brew pub, which sort of started the craft beer fire in Vermont. And he ended up opening the seven barrel brewery in New Hampshire as well. But I think his legacy lives on really, really strongly. And you look at Sean Hill from Hill Farmstead, you look at John Kimmick from The Alchemist, you look at all these guys that have rockstar breweries in Vermont, and they're all his students. His direct students. So that's
it was sort of this one guy who found fertile ground.
You can't deny his legacy in the Vermont brew industry. I think it would be impossible.
What do you think?
I think, this is like poking the bear a little bit because.
Sorry about that.
It's one of my soapbox topics here. As my background is all in marketing, and I sit back and I just look at our state. I love our state, right? But if you look at Maine, what do you think? You think lobsters, and I'm going to go vacation there and go pick blueberries with my family, and we're going to go hang out by the ocean, and we're going to have some craft beer. And I think about Vermont, and you think quaint little B&Bs and beautiful mountains and craft beer. And you think of New Hampshire, you know, our state brand. What is it? That's a good question.
And Vermont actually has a long history of agricultural promotion. They've got a whole agency dedicated to that and so on and so forth. So we'll poke the bear a little bit more after a short break. All right. And you can join us too with your calls, 1-800-892-6477. Coming up, we'll also hear from an economist who studies the business of craft beer across the country. All that's coming up, so stay with us.
This week on the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop, author Michael Cunningham has advice we can all take to heart, no matter what you do.
You have to figure out when it's time to just let it go, when this is all you can do. Over the years, I have developed a slightly better sense of when I've reached that point, when in rewriting, I'm not making it better, but I'm just making it different.
Subscribe to the podcast for sage advice or find some at nhpr.org/10mww.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the craft beer boom in New Hampshire. What's its economic impact? That question was posed recently to our Only in New Hampshire series, and that we set out to answer. You can check out producer Taylor Quimby's story on that at nhpr.org. And you can join us with your questions and comments right now. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have two New Hampshire brewers in studio, and with us now on the phone is Bart Watson. He's chief economist at the Brewers Association, an organization that promotes and assists small and independent craft brewers nationwide. And Bart, really nice to have you in the Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, we talked about this with our guests in studio earlier, Bart, but I'd love your thoughts too. What is craft brewing? What's the official definition, if there is one?
So for our statistics at the Brewers Association, we define a craft brewer as one that's small, independent, and traditional. And basically that breaks down to a brewer that makes 3% or less of the U.S. beer market share, a brewer who doesn't have an ownership stake by a large brewer, and a brewer who's making primarily beer as opposed to flavored malt beverages or something else.
And why is that independence so important? Some people say that, you know, the crafty beers made by the big guys taste pretty good.
Well, you know, I mean, that's going to be, you know, up to the beer lover what they want. And certainly there are lots of breweries that make great beer. But, you know, our mission and our passion is to promote truly independent brewers and, you know, to tell their stories. And we think there's a difference there, too, in terms of the advantages in the marketplace that, you know, a small independent brewer is going to have if they're not attached to one of the multinational brewers with access to distribution and raw materials and things like that. So, you know, lots of brewers can make great beer, but certainly there's differences in the market based on if you're independent or if you're, you know, attached to a large company.
I'd like to ask about the new label, Bart, that your group has come up with to help consumers distinguish between large scale beer production and smaller scale. What does this new label look like?
Yeah, it's an upside down bottle. And the idea is that, you know, craft brewers have turned the beer industry upside down. So the symbol tries to capture that. And, you know, this is really in response to, you know, something we saw in a lot of our data, which is that a high percentage of craft purchasers do want to support small and independent businesses. We did a survey with Nielsen this year, and it was 55% of craft purchasers said they factor small and independent into their purchase decision. But with so many acquisitions, with so much going on, it was challenging for a lot of them to know which was which. And so we think this seal will be a great way to provide consumer information and allow consumers who care about this and want to support independent brewers to know where their dollars are going.
So acquisitions, that means when the big companies buy up smaller breweries. And so they're still making their own beer, but they're under the auspices of, you know, Anheuser-Busch or Coors or something.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we're seeing this as a general trend as, you know, fuller flavored beer has gotten more popular. The large brewers have looked to acquire their way into this market as well as build some of their own brands. And, you know, it's challenging. I mean, I have the privilege of getting to think about beer all day, every day. So, you know, I know when someone's been acquired. But, you know, if you're just somebody who likes great beer, but still wants to support your local independent businesses, it can be challenging to keep track of. So that's where we think the seal fits in, and we'll do a good job of consumer awareness.
How widely has this seal been adopted, Bart?
We're moving toward 2,000 breweries that have you know, signed our licensing agreement and said they're gonna look into using it. You know, we'll see. It's gonna take a little while to get its way out into packages. You know, brewers don't necessarily turn over their packaging immediately, so they're gonna have to run through stock, you know, incorporate it into their design. But we think it's gonna start popping up. You're already seeing it in breweries all across the country. You know, putting up the seal on their tap room or, you know, making up provisional labels for festivals and things like that. So we're hoping we're going to see it all across the country pretty soon.
Sure. Well, speaking of making provisional labels, is there a hassle factor or a cost factor in terms of, you know, your mother-in-law crafted this beautiful label for your beer and now you have to change it. You have to put this new logo on.
You know, certainly, you know, there may be small costs associated with it. And we're not expecting any brewer to bear any costs that they can't afford. So, you know, again, this is, you know, when you're redoing your labels or when you're ordering more, you know, incorporating this as part of the design element, you know, we're not expecting any brewers going to throw anything away or, you know, alter their label in a major way. This is something that, you know, would be additional in the packaging. And, you know, consumers know to look for some of these, you know, energy safe. I mean, you know, that doesn't take away from, you know, the GE logo on your refrigerator. It's a different one. It's there. It's part of that consumer information about what you're purchasing.
You know, last question for you, Bart, please. We talked just a few minutes ago with our guests about Vermont's stellar reputation for craft beer. What other states are known as fabulous places for beer? And what do they do that perhaps New Hampshire doesn't?
Well, the list is growing. I mean, it used to really be only a handful of states, but we now see lots of states that are very well known. Certainly the West Coast states, Oregon, Washington, California, you know, Colorado, you know, Michigan in the Midwest, and, you know, parts of the Northeast, you know, Vermont and Maine are probably up there as well. And, you know, what do they do? I think it's a combination of things. You know, they have great regulatory environments that allowed breweries to flourish. You know, they have great brewing communities and often home brewing communities that allow brewers to get started up. And then I think you see something of a self-fulfilling cycle where great brewers, you know, lead to more breweries, they lead to consumer awareness. And so we're seeing other states that are starting to begin that upward cycle. And hopefully that list of great brewing states is only going to grow as we move forward.
Okay. Bart, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Bart Watson, chief economist at the Brewers Association. Again, that's an organization that promotes independent craft brewers nationwide. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Nicole and Michael, before we go to our listeners, I did want to pick up on what Bart said, Nicole, about the regulatory environment. You and Michael talked earlier about nano breweries and how that law really helped people get going here in New Hampshire. Are there other sort of rules and regs here in New Hampshire that you feel are difficult?
We're both laughing. No one can see this. There's always, you know, a set of challenges when it comes to legislation and, you know, like government issues and processes and paperwork that actually there's a lot of streamlining that can be done. And there's one law called, well, chapter, what's it called, 176 or 178, but the Liquor Commission's actually looking at that right now and how to revamp it so that things can be a little bit more streamlined.
Because New Hampshire is what's called a control state, where the state is in charge of, I mean, states always regulate their alcohol sales,
yep.
But New Hampshire and 16 or 17 other states are these official control states, so there might be more rules.
Yeah, well, frankly, I'd love to be able to sell my brew and beer in some of the quote liquor stores in the state, you know, and that's something that we can't
or even
do.
The folks that have wine only licenses. I have a friend that owns a deli and she can sell wine by the bottle there, but she can't sell beer by the bottle there, which always strikes me as odd. I think my biggest challenge in dealing with New Hampshire liquor laws, and frankly I'm not just saying this because I'm on the radio, but the Liquor Commission's been really, really cool to us. They're really easy to deal with, but they're working with a tapestry of laws that is not consistent and not coherent. It's this piece came apart at this point because of this thing, and then this piece of law came about because of this other thing that's completely unrelated.
Some of them date back to Prohibition.
And they don't tie together.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of things where it's assumption where, okay, well, there's a strict law that you can do this as a beverage manufacturer, and there's a law you can do this as a brew pub, but there's no RSA you can point to as to whether or not you can do it as a nano. And we've been hitting that wall a lot more lately as we've been in a really rapid growth phase. And we're starting to hit up against some walls where, well, there's not necessarily a legislation piece for exactly what you're trying to do. So what is the government going to do? Are they going to err on the side of caution, or are they going to throw caution to the wind? And generally, governments err on the side of caution. And so that's where I think we have our logistical challenges, is just as Nicole said, helping them to streamline those processes so they're spending less time too, because, you know, they're coming to us and they're wanting to look at our food receipts because we have to sell food in order to sell pints. And if the laws were easier to deal with, they wouldn't have to spend tax money on people auditing my food receipts. And they don't want to do that, I don't think.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, because New Hampshire for a long time has had a law that says you can't just sell alcohol, you have to sell food. So does that law apply, Michael, to nano breweries too?
It does. And when the Nano Act first came out, it did not allow for pints. It allowed you to pour 1 4-ounce sample per variety, per person, per day. So if you had 10 beers on tap, you could pour 10 4-ounce samples as long as you weren't over-serving. But if you only had 3 beers on tap, you could pour somebody 12 ounces of beer, and that was the end of their retail experience.
Then they would have to say thank you.
They wanted to take stuff home, and then they could take packaging home. But what the Nano Plus Act allowed people to do is meet certain standards set by the Liquor Commission for food preparation and by virtue of that be allowed to have pints. And they pretty much give you four boxes and you got to check three of them.
So how fussy is the state about the definition of food? I mean,
it's very particular.
Adding food, it's a whole other element, right? You got to have a kitchen and all of a sudden you're under a whole new set of regulations. I mean, you can't just, you know, whip out a box of cheese and crackers, right, Nicole?
I actually think that depends per town as well.
Also, there's town rules and regulations,
too. Yeah, because the town has to come in and, you know, make sure that everything is according to what their specifications are. But it's interesting, you know, because we're on the seacoast and you just take a short drive into Maine and they don't have any of those requirements. So I could go to, for example, Tributary Brewing. I could have some beers and they don't offer, you know, food. And same with, you know, all the breweries in Maine. They're able to sell people pints of beer without having to have a full kitchen.
On site.
Yep.
Or to take away.
Yes.
On site. Okay, so here's the other question, though. I mean, I think part of the reason those rules around food came about is you don't want people driving drunk. You know, you want some food maybe so people can absorb the alcohol. New Hampshire has a very high binge drinking rate, alcohol abuse, big substance abuse problem, and that's even with the opioid crisis we hear so much about. So I just wonder what you guys' thoughts are on that. I mean, you know, not to put a damper on the party here, but alcohol abuse is a big problem in New Hampshire, Nicole.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is. And I'd, well, put it this way. If you come to our brewery, sometimes there's more kids than parents, right? So, like, there's so many people, and it's a family experience, right? I think people might have the wrong idea of what going to a brewery is.
Agreed.
It's people aren't coming to our place to get hammered.
It's like a British pub.
Absolutely. And I think this applies to most of the breweries across the state. It's a family experience when you come to our place or you're coming with your friends to have a good time. It's very rare that we have to cut someone off. And listen, like as a brewery owner, the last thing in the world that I want to do is overserve anyone. So I think the onus has always been on the breweries to make sure that you're not overserving. So you know, whether you have food or not, it's going to be the same thing. We're going to be very diligent and careful about how we're, you know, how many beers we're giving people. So,
do you want to jump in on that, Michael?
We used to actually put menus out for a local pizza place before we serve food, and you could order food in, and that way we didn't have to touch the food.
Oh, that's a little synergy there.
But unfortunately, the state doesn't at this point have legislation to allow that to allow you to do pints.
Now, that's
you
a good synergy, though. Somebody could open up a pizza shop next to your place in that funny little pocket mall.
A food truck, which is what most states do.
Yep.
And it just we don't have a food truck culture, so I don't even think that that's permeated our legislature yet. But we're on our way. But another 5 years when we have a food truck culture, and maybe that will be something that can be pitched as a law, and maybe it'll actually fly this time.
I was in Boston recently, and I couldn't believe the amount of food trucks. It was hard to decide. So that's an interesting idea. All right, to our listeners, again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. We're talking about the economics of the craft beer mini boom here in the Granite State and why that boom seems bigger in some of our neighboring states. 1-800-892-6477. Beer as a tool of economic development. That's the topic today in the Exchange. Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Again, email exchange@nhpr.org. A couple emails, folks. Here's one from Michael who says, can you ask your guests if they use local ingredients when making flavored beers, blueberries, strawberries, pumpkins, etc.? Given the lead time of brewing, it seems like local growers and brewers are out of step, i.e. pumpkin brew on the shelf before pumpkins are locally ready. Is there a way, Michael asks, as a local grower can make our products appealing to local brewers? More synergies then between local farms and local beers. Go ahead, Nicole.
Yeah, I mean, this one hits home for me because we try and get all of our ingredients from within 200 miles of the brewery.
Wow.
Yeah, and part of that, there are challenges. Like, we probably have more freezers than anyone because when someone wants, for example, our watermelon beer in July, watermelon's not ready in the state of New Hampshire until, what, at best case, like late August. So we'll
local watermelon.
Local, yeah. So we'll work with, for example, like Abby at Wake Robin Farm. Like, we'll get watermelon from her and then we'll freeze it. And then so we'll be able to have our watermelon at the appropriate time. Same with our rhubarb for our rhubarb wit. And our pumpkin, we use pumpkins that are local from Blueberry Bay Farm in Stratum. And then the unfortunate, I guess, result of that is our beer is ready in perfect season, but some of these larger breweries that actually don't use pumpkin, just flavorings in their beer to achieve the pumpkin, have that coming out in August. Or June. Yeah. So we're at the late end of the cycle when you would think it's seasonally appropriate to have that beer. But now all of the seasonal beers are being pushed up early and earlier because there was some reports done that said some of the first seasonal beers to appear on the shelves appeal to the consumer. They pick that brand and they sort of stick with it. So there's been this fight over like who gets to the shelf
with their pumpkin beer first. Oh, that's interesting. So there's pressure to get to the shelf with your pumpkin beer first, even if your pumpkin beer is kind of just flavored with shots of fake pumpkin juice.
Yes. Yep.
Do you want to jump in, Michael?
I think Nicole is the rock star of using local ingredients. I think that's what you guys are known for is, I mean, not just making awesome beer, but using local ingredients. We try to use local ingredients when we can. It is tough because sometimes it's tough to incorporate whole fruit just because they can have bacteria and yeast on the surface. So you have to treat them. Kind of depends on if you add them, where in the process. But the other side of that, I think, is also the giving back to the farmers, and that all of our spent grain as brewers generally goes to local farmers to feed their livestock. And that's something that a lot of people don't realize as well. And that kind of ties it back to what you had said earlier about what it's like in Germany, where there's a brewery in every town. Before Prohibition in America, there was a brewery in every town, and they were part of a very tight little sort of circle of life, as it were, where they were getting their produce from farmers, and they were giving their spent grains to farmers, and they were giving their yeast to the bread baker, who was also using it to bake his bread. And it was this intricate little web that kept the ecosystem of your small
town. Sounds like a medieval town.
Healthy. It is. It was. I mean, pre-Walmart, pre-World War II, that's what it was. And I think people are just starting to realize that they don't only have to go to the 100,000 square foot place and get the same thing that all their neighbors are getting.
Here's an email from Steve in Canterbury who says, my business model for a nano brewery is nano. Yeah. My focus is super local sales, tasting and growlers from the brewery only. Low overhead, Steve says. One-man show makes my margin very efficient. My tasting room is always crazy busy. People are even starting to complain about how crowded it is. Still, Steve says, I have no plan to expand. And I wonder about that. Are you officially a nano, Nicole?
No, we transitioned from a nano brewery to a brew pub about 2 years ago.
Okay, so, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is Steve from Canterbury Aleworks. Fabulous location. It's a great example of what a brewery in New Hampshire is. Like, you go to his little farm, he's got hops growing, he built his own system.
It's water powered.
Yeah. but what Steve is saying, if we're talking about economics, so when we started, people said to us 6 years ago, you cannot have a viable brewery unless you have a 7-barrel brewery. And we set out to prove them wrong. But the model back then was you make beer, you distribute beer. So best case, you're making like $500 on the barrel. However, if you have a tasting room, people are coming to you, like Steve said, you can make, you know, if you selling the equivalent of a $6 beer, that's $1,500 per barrel, right? So instead of only keeping like 33 cents on the dollar, you're keeping the whole dollar, which is why breweries like Steve's and other small nano breweries can be successful in the state.
And I read something that said some real fans of craft brew, you know, they'll drive 2 hours.
Absolutely.
They'll drive two hours to wait two hours.
Wow. Okay. A lot more after a short break. Thank you for those emails, Steve and Michael. We'll take more of yours in just a moment. You can email us at exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Coming up, beer brewing studies at UNH. We'll find out more. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, what are the economics of the craft beer boom in New Hampshire? That's what we're looking at this hour. We're also hoping some of you can help us out with a show that we're planning for later this month. With the start of another school year coming up, we want to hear from teachers. The Exchange is putting together a teacher roundtable show. We're looking to hear from educators. What are your hopes for the new school year? What issues are you focused on? What are the biggest challenges in your district? Let us know. We'd love to hear from you. If you're a teacher, send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Hope you can help us out with this show we're planning. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. We'd love to hear from you right now about craft brewing here in the Granite State. The number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And Nicole Carrier, Michael Hopley-Pierce, I want to bring another voice into our conversation. With us now on the line, Cheryl Parker. She's brewery manager for UNH's Brewing Science Minor in the College of Life Sciences and Agriculture. Cheryl was formerly a brewer at Nicole's Place, Throwback Brewery. And Cheryl, it's really nice to have you. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for having me on the show.
So when did UNH start offering a beer minor?
Well, it's actually starting this fall.
Oh, so brand new.
Course is going to be brand new, yeah. The first course starts this fall. And if you're a student listening, the course just got listed in the course catalog last week. It's SAFS 415, but you can just search for brewing and it'll come up.
How old do you have to be to take these classes? I mean, drinking age is 21.
Yep, so for the most part, you don't have to be 21. There will be at least one of the courses you will have to be 21. I'll tell you a little bit about the course, two of the courses, actually. The first course this fall, you do not need to be 21, and that's the Intro to Brewing, and I'll be teaching that. And it's going to take students all the way from growing the raw ingredients all the way through production. So it'll encompass everything, which is really great when you're talking about jobs, because the jobs aren't just in brewing. They're in agriculture, they're in malting, they're in sales and distribution.
Marketing and so forth, label design.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
But hang on, Cheryl, sorry to interrupt, but you said that this is the first class that you don't have to be 21 to take, you know, takes you all the way from the beginning to final production, but the students can't legally taste what they've made?
This course, we will not be tasting beer because we do want to make sure that students can get into this minor and finish all of the courses. We'll be bringing a lot of guest speakers into this introduction course, so I want to get them really excited about meeting these people and what their challenges were and why they're excited to brew. The second course in the spring, that'll be in our brewery, so this will be one of the courses the students will take as part of the minor. And in that course, you will need to be 21 because we're actually building a small brewery on campus. The students will be making the beer, they'll be doing experiments, they'll be testing out new ideas and gaining some of those skills that are going to be really important for getting jobs. And in that course, you will have to taste the product as we go. So that course, you will have to be 21. But hopefully, you know, for a lot of students, that might be the course they take their senior year.
Was there any questioning or pushback, Cheryl, about, you know, whether you wanted to promote alcohol consumption on a college campus, given huge concerns about underage drinking or even drinking by people who are legal but don't have a lot of experience mm-hmm. and tend to go overboard?
Yeah, actually, we've had a really great reception for this program. People are really excited about it. I think one of those reasons is because this is a growing job market. I mean, what better way to keep, in New Hampshire, we want to keep these students in the state after they graduate. And this is going to be a huge industry for them, whether they want to stay here and open a business or work for one or maybe go into malting. We don't have a malt house in New Hampshire. But, you know, aside from that, you know, I think education is always what's going to help those things. When you sort of say, oh, we're not going to learn about this, that makes the problem worse. But to give students an appreciation, I mean, brewing encompasses, a lot of people don't realize this, brewing encompasses chemistry, biology, microbiology, biochemistry, physics, engineering, all of these things. And we're going to be learning this from a scientific approach. So what do you need to know to make good beer? Because as things get more competitive, it's not going to be enough to be able to make good beer. You're going to have to make it consistently.
Yeah, and marketing as well, for sure, because we heard about the difficulty of, you know, getting your stuff on right. The shelves or getting people to drive 2 hours to come taste. What's the interest of most students, do you think, Cheryl, who will sign up for this course? Do you think they want to become business people, brewers? Do they want to be like our emailer in Canterbury who just wants to keep it mm-hmm. small? I mean, what do you think their interest is going to be?
You know, I think it's going to really span the whole range. I assume I'll get some students who just want to be good home brewers, but I do hope I get students who want to get into the industry because the craft beer community is the best community of people out there. I just can't imagine being in a different industry right now, and it's so fun and welcoming. The great thing about this minor is that you can major in anything at the university. So you can be a business major, art major, science major, and you can minor in brewing. So I'm really hoping to get a great mix of students, maybe a business student who wants to open a brewery someday. But it'll be very important for them to understand all the steps of the process, especially quality control. Why is that end of it important for your business? Or I might get a student who's a biology major and really wants to work in a lab. But to be able to understand the whole process from start to finish is going to give them that extra edge.
Okay, Cheryl, good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
That's Cheryl Parker, brewery manager for UNH's Brewing Science Minor, which, as she told us, is a brand new minor starting up this fall in the College of Life Sciences and Agriculture. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Michael and Nicole, right back to our listeners. Carolyn's calling from Keene. Hi, Carolyn. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm a professor at Keene State College, and I've been lucky enough to be interviewing craft brewers across the United States. And my real question today is, what can New Hampshire do to really become a beer destination? I think it's really an undercapitalized opportunity for the state. And next door, we have Maine and Vermont that are really booming. And so the question is what can New Hampshire do besides having these educational programs? What can the state do? What can local communities do to
sure.
really support the brewers as
so
they grow?
How can New Hampshire become a better beer destination? Well, real quickly, what do you think, Carolyn?
I think that a lot of the tourism could help. I think actually the best thing that could happen right now is that we come up with a way to make New Hampshire have an identity as a brew place. And so what is it that makes New Hampshire unique, and how can we sort of link that together?
Okay.
About things like living free or dying. And maybe there's a way to link that into the beer community. So there's just a solid identity of this is what New Hampshire beer is. This is how we're different from the surrounding states. And how can we help each other out? And what the last speaker was saying, I think, is absolutely right. It's a great community of people. There's so much camaraderie around the process that they're just really great models.
Well, Carolyn, yeah, and Nicole is absolutely nodding her head because we started to touch on this before,
yeah.
Nicole, when I poked the bear, as you put it, and said, why is Vermont considered better than New Hampshire? So go ahead.
Yeah, so I guess the end of my soapbox there that I started before is that I feel like the part of our problem, if you will, as New Hampshire brewers is directly tied to our identity and brand as a state, right? So there are, Maine and Vermont have such cachet, right? And if you think of New Hampshire, it's politics, man in the mountain, which no longer exists, and a couple other things, but we have so much to offer in this state. And I think if we had more of a compelling brand, and if anyone has any ideas, you know, of how to better market New Hampshire, I think that would greatly impact and help us breweries in the state. Because I think we make as good beer as the states around us. I'd love to have some blind taste test where we go head to head.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Like
and
a tri-state challenge.
Tri-state challenge. I think people would be really surprised how New Hampshire would kick butt in that competition. But I do think also it comes down to tourism and tourism dollars. We're going to try and go for a grant because as we talked about before, beer tourism is a real thing. And the more that our state invests in tourism and beer tourism, the more that it will help everyone out in the state.
Go ahead, Michael. Love your thoughts here. And I love your question, Carolyn, by the way. It's a great one.
I think first and foremost, find your local brewery and buy their beer. Or if you're not a beer drinker, tell your friends about them. And when you have family and friends come from out of state, take them there. And spread the word, because the tourist dollars are great, but that it's not the everyday thing. I think building deep roots versus wide roots is what makes breweries in New Hampshire successful. And I help them do that by supporting the one that's close to you, or several of them that are close to you, or even one that's an hour away, but that you like. You know, drive to Hampton, go to Throwback, even if you live in Manchester. They would love it. They would love your business. They would love your support. And they'd love you to tell their story to the next person that you meet. I think that's huge. And I think the steps that the New Hampshire Brewers Association has taken over the course of the last 3 years are instrumental in us creating that identity for not just the beer, but for the state in general, with beer as a part of that. We didn't really have a strong association before a few years ago. We didn't have an association at all before like 4 years ago. So we're really in the infancy where the surrounding states, you know, Vermont's Brewers Association has been around for like 15 or 20 years. It's that. And I think that is going to be key to the growth, is having the strong infrastructure, but also having the strong local support, where it's just like you buy your beef from your neighbor that has cows, and you buy your zucchini from your neighbor that has a farm. You buy your beer from your neighbor that has a brewery.
Well, and I was talking to a friend of mine who knows a lot more about this than I do, looking at the list of states that are considered like top, you know, great beer destinations and other states that aren't considered. And New Jersey was pretty far down on the list. And I said, gee, that's kind of funny. New Jersey, you know, high income state, probably a lot of people there who, you know, would enjoy a good beer. And she said they have really tough regulations. So it's kind of what gets what you said earlier, Michael. Local rules, state rules make a difference.
It's $500,000 in New Jersey to get a liquor license to open a brewery. $500,000.
And New York is right next door. So if you're going to open a brewery, you just hop across the border.
Sure.
It's a lot easier.
I think the other thing that we have to overcome is the way that beer flows in and out of the state. And I think that has made New Hampshire less of a beer state because we haven't been able to get beer from out of state into the state. And so our retail hasn't been known for having a great selection. And I think people see that as a reflection of the state at large, even though it's really a reflection of what's happening outside of the state. And that really comes down to what it costs to bring beer from out of state in state for wholesale distribution.
Wow. And why? I've always wondered this. Why isn't beer sold at the New Hampshire State Liquor Store? Those are so heavily promoted, and that's a whole other show that we need to look at, is whether this is appropriate for New Hampshire to be selling, you know, mega amounts of liquor right by the highway. But setting that aside just for the moment, why isn't beer available at the liquor store? Wouldn't that be a great boost for you guys?
It would be fantastic. And I actually, I don't know.
Let's talk about advertising.
Yeah, I'm just guessing that I think there's a perception that there's a higher margin on the liquor bottle so that they can make more money. But beer turns over a lot faster. Like you could sell a six-pack and keep replacing it. And
maybe it's a cold storage issue as well. Maybe it's just a, I don't know.
We don't know.
I see. Okay.
We would love to be there, though, because when people come from out of state, that's where they expect to be able to go to get beer. Yep. And they say, oh, we went to the liquor store, but we couldn't find you.
Right. That's the thing. And when you stop off at those giant welcome centers off the highway, it's very New Hampshire focused. And, you know, New Hampshire cider, New Hampshire donuts, New Hampshire ice cream.
Yep, no beer.
Cheap liquor, no beer. All right. Well, we'll set that aside for the moment. Here's an email from Chris who says, great show about craft brewing in New Hampshire. I am planning to start a brewery in my barn in a rural part of the state, Croydon, but I've been told by the Liquor Commission that they will no longer grant a nano brewery license for operations on private property, even though many already exist. Chris says, to me, this runs against the spirit of the law and will hamper continued growth in the industry, especially in more rural areas of the state. Can you address this, Nicole? We talked earlier about, you know, nano breweries aren't just seen as economic engines for, you know, Portsmouth and Hanover and Concord, but also for little pockets of rural New Hampshire, which are struggling.
Yeah, I mean, that's surprising to
I'd
me.
Heard that because I know Tom Albright, who owns Outhouse Ales, used to have he had an outbuilding on his property where he opened his brewery, and he got through all the licensing and the state was fine with it. And I think the last one, who's the guy that's doing all sours in really small batches? Atwater? I think he was the last one that was granted a private property liquor license by the state. And I honestly don't know if an RSA has changed or if an interpretation has changed, but I've heard from other people that they were refused by the State Liquor Commission a license on private property, even in an outbuilding, because that was the stipulation before, and I think that comes down from federal that you can't have it attached to your house like you can have a homestead kitchen or a homestead business of another kind where it's in your house, in your living room, and next to your house. It had to be a freestanding building, not attached to your house, but it could be on your private property, and the state's not allowing that anymore.
And I don't know why, especially if you're in a rural area, and you're acres and acres away from your nearest neighbors. Why not? Because, like, that's the only thing I can think of because small breweries, even no matter how small, they draw consumers and customers.
But that's the concern sometimes.
Right. So, right. But if you are really
in
the middle of nowhere. Exactly. Right. But if you're really in the middle of nowhere.
We did a whole program about a year ago. It was a great program about this sort of ag tourism.
Yeah.
And some of these farms have started to expand to have, like, you know, weddings and you know, reunions and stuff as a way to boost their farms, boost their income so they can stay on the land. And then, you know, there are neighbors who say, no, it's noisy. Like, I live in this little town because it's quiet. And if you open up a brewery, Nicole, next door, all of a sudden I'm going to have cars and maybe drunk people and maybe my kids get hit by a drunk driver. And I mean, there's that side of it.
Yeah, but and again, it goes back to what I was saying before about as business owners, we're you train your staff to not overserve people. So it does happen. You know, I assume people have these stories because it happens someplace. But I think if you're a really responsible business owner, that's the last thing in the world that you want to to have happen.
We almost never have to shut people off. We're super diligent, but it's few and far between. People don't come to my place to get drunk. They come to my place to have good beer and conversation and hang out with the brewers.
Last question for you. True confessions, I'm not a beer drinker. I've managed to host this whole hour.
I'm out of here.
Yeah. I waited until the end to tell you. So what's in this for me? I mean, I've tried to like beer for, 30 years, and I just can't stand it.
Yeah. Oh. Well, listen, like, we still love you, so that's
good.
Okay. And this is why we serve wine at our brewery as well.
Thank you.
But I really feel like there's so many different varieties of beer now that if you came to my place, I could find one beer that you like. And
that's a challenge.
What I usually, so come on by. But here's the thing. There are, for example, beers like our German-style wheat beer that doesn't have a lot of hops. Some people don't like bitter. If I say to you, do you like coffee? Yeah, I like coffee. I've had people actually like one of our dark beers called Oma's Tribute because it has these really coffee notes and it's sort of light in body. There's sour beers, which don't really taste like beer at all. And it's very, effervescent and it's a little puckery on your palate. And so there's so many different styles and varieties of beer that I think it's, even though it might be a challenge, I feel like we could, get a beer that you would like to drink.
What do you think, Michael? You're a little closer to home for me than Nicole.
I agree. I think that what people think of as quote-unquote beer is often a much narrower range of stuff than what beer really encompasses. And if you don't like malt, there's beers that aren't malty. If you don't like hops, there's beers that aren't hoppy. There's beers that are neither of those things. We have a peach sour on right now that it doesn't taste super malty or super hoppy. You might even like it.
Cider, pear cider, apple cider, hard ciders, do those count?
I can't do those on my license. She can.
Okay, it's a separate thing.
Yep.
Do you
once
do that?
Again, separate provisions for separate licenses.
Laws,
that don't agree with each
rules,
other.
Regs. Yeah. Do you do the ciders?
We don't make cider, no.
Okay. But you could if you wanted to.
If we got a federal license to do that, yes.
Okay.
That's a whole other topic. Yeah.
Well, the reason I raised it is I did get an email from Dan who said, don't forget to talk about craft hard cider. So, Dan, there you go. Guys, this has been really fun. Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. Michael, great to meet you.
You as well. Thank you.
That's Michael Hauptley Pierce, owner and brewer at Litherman's Limited in Concord, host of the Beer Podcast, The Tap Handle Show. Nicole, good to meet you too. Thank you.
Nice to meet you.
Nicole Carrier, co-founder, president of Throwback Brewery in Northampton, president of the New Hampshire Brewers Association. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.